You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Josh.
Hello, Bob. Great to be with you.
Great to have you here. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the eminently rateable and reviewable Non-Zero Podcast, and you are Joshua Landis. You're at the University of Oklahoma, where you're in the Sandra Mackey Chair of Middle East Studies and the Director of the Center of Middle East Studies, not to mention a fellow at the Quincy Institute, I guess a virtual fellow since that's in Washington, but a fellow nonetheless. And you know a lot about the Middle East. I mean, I guess Syria is your specialty, but you keep track of things pretty broadly there. There's a lot going on there. I actually want to eventually get to some developments in Syria. I also want to get to President Trump's suggestion that we should encourage conflict between Syria and Hezbollah, but let's hold off on that. What I mainly want to talk about is, you know, in a way, the consequences of the war, the Iran war. First of all, the prospects for the ceasefire as you see them, but then, you know, assuming the ceasefire holds, and what are the potential kind of tectonic shifts in the long run? I mean, I think this war promises to really change some fundamental dynamics in the Middle East. And I'm curious as your take on what the range of possibilities is. But so I don't know. Do you have anything just to offer right off the bat in the way
I think you're absolutely right. This is a tectonic shift. You know, some people have been comparing it to the Suez Crisis and sort of the last roar of the British Empire. But it isn't that. The American Empire is still big. It's strong. The American military is powerful. And America is still a great power. It's not, unlike Britain, you know, food isn't being still rationed in the post-World War II period. And Britain was completely dependent on the United States. The United States is not completely dependent on any power, even though it's got a giant debt and a big deficit and many problems that we can see in our immediate future. But this is clearly a big blow to American power. And it's it is already, we can see the beginnings of some clear policy changes amongst people in the Middle East and around the world.
Let me ask you a specific question. Can you imagine a situation a couple of years from now where some of the U.S. military bases in the Persian Gulf states are no longer there?
Yes, I can. You know, they got hit very badly. The drone warfare, missile warfare that Iran was able to put together and sustain, despite being pummeled, clearly brings into question all these bases that run in its giant sort of string of pearls along the Persian Gulf, the Arab side of the Persian Gulf. All of those countries are going to have to reevaluate. Does America actually increase their safety by having those bases? Or, in fact, does it make them more vulnerable? As it turned out in this war, to make them more vulnerable. And that was Iran's major excuse for bombing all of these countries and really trashing their economies, because they said these countries are siding with America to hurt us, and therefore we're going to hurt them and the international economy in doing so. And that was the leverage, and it turned out to be very powerful leverage against the United States. And it's what's caused this recent ceasefire by President Trump.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering what your take on this is. It's common to call this a strategic defeat for the U.S., and it certainly is, in the sense that the strategic aims of the Trump administration were thwarted, were not fulfilled. This is not what they expected. And if you look at the ceasefire agreement, which we apparently now have a reliable copy of, I mean, CNN ran something that seems to be the real thing, and it looks like, yeah, Iran came out of it pretty well. So, yeah, you can call it a strategic defeat, but, you know, my own take is, it may be better for America and for Middle Eastern peace and stability and conceivably Israel. But in any event, that the war turned out the way it did rather than the way it was intended. I mean, certainly if you compare it to alternatives like just state collapse and civil war, I would say, within Iran, which was kind of plan B after the clean Venezuela-like regime change didn't happen, I guess. I don't know. I think this could lead to a better Middle East. It's complicated. I'd have to lay out what I mean by that. But does that seem crazy to you to say that there's a certain sense in which if you're really focused on American national interests, and leave aside whatever the aims of the Trump administration were, that this could lead to a better world than we had before? Is that completely crazy?
Well, I think it's, to your point, what we've seen here is that the United States and Israeli power has sort of hit the end of their leash. Starting with the Gaza campaign, October 7th, Israel has been on a march. And I think Prime Minister Netanyahu has felt that Israel has been invincible. And it could not only smash the Palestinians and begin to take much of the rest of the West Bank and push Palestinians out of many villages into much smaller territory with the hope of eventually perhaps expelling them or finding some kind of transfer to other countries. But then hitting Hezbollah, overturning the Syrian regime, hitting the Houthis, the string of really dramatic wins for Israel made Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump believe that they could take down Iran and that this would be the final crown on this string of victories and that they would destroy the entire axis of resistance, as it was called, and the balance of power in the Middle East. Because after all, Iran and this axis of resistance had been had presented a deterrent to Israel. Israel did not dare to bomb Iran because Hezbollah would pound them with rockets and they would get hurt. And that balance of power, it wasn't really a balance of power, but that deterrence was important. And it survived throughout the history of Hezbollah. And that all of a sudden disappeared. And as Michael Oren, who is Israeli ambassador to the United States, went to Princeton as a neighbor of yours, and she was a classmate of mine for a short period at Princeton. But he wrote an important article at the dawn of this war in which he said it would be foolish for Israel and America not to capitalize on all of these successes and to take down the Iranian regime. If we can cap it off by taking down the Iranian regime, we will have really maximized our strategic advantage. And this will be the end. It'll be the beginning of a totally new Middle East. Now, obviously, I think that spirit was driving President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu. The fact that it failed, and failed rather spectacularly, is going to chasten the United States and is going to chasten Israel to a certain degree. Now, I don't want to overplay this because we thought, at least I did, that the Iraq debacle would chase the United States, that Afghanistan would chase the United States, that this string of really failed wars across the Middle East, regime change wars, would have chastened America. And President Trump pretended, acted as if he was chastened, that America was, that these were stupid wars. He criticized President Bush for turning Iraq into what he called the Harvard of jihadism and so forth. And yet he could not keep himself and Washington from trying to do the great regime change in Iran. And now, will this stabilize the Middle East? I think it's going to take a while. The Middle East is a smoking ruin today. Yeah. Now, the Gulf states are an exception to this. But, you know, if we look at Lebanon, where 20% of the population has been displaced, dozens of villages have been completely smashed, over 60 have been bombed, and lots of people have been killed. Syria, 90% of people living in poverty, about 80%, according to the UN, food insecure. Mm-hmm. And Iraq is still in terrible shape. We can go across the Middle East and look at really the dismal shape. I mean, Egypt is not bankrupt, but it's constantly threatening to go bankrupt. And the IMF and other countries throw money at it periodically. Mm-hmm. Sudan is in terrible civil war. There's one problem after the next. Yemen. So that this is going to stabilize the Middle East may be a little bit hopeful.
Too optimistic. Well, let me lay out the logic behind the hope, and the hope yes. is all it is. I guess I'd say two things. One is, of course, you know, the fundamental fissure in the region has been kind of Israel versus Iran. Two potentially very powerful countries. And I guess I would say the sustenance of that fissure has been related to America's involvement, the form of involvement. They basically said, yeah, we're with Israel. I mean, especially Trump, you know, more than Obama, but basically all presidents, when push comes to shove, if there's a conflict between Israel and Iran, we're on Israel's side. And with both Biden and Trump, you know, we'll give you, you can start the war, whatever, but we will give you the backup you need that gives you the assurance that you can fight and so on. Not to mention the fact that we have helped preserve sanctions on Iran, which has, you know, kept them weakened and so on. So that's one thing. And if you look at the ceasefire agreement, which we can get to, assuming, again, all this holds, and there are reasons you can imagine it not holding, but you can imagine, I mean, it almost seems to be to anticipate Iran's reintegration into the world economy. I mean, it's, you know, right away, I gather there's sanctions relief. It's vaguer on the unfreezing of assets, but my guess is there's going to be de facto unfreezing of assets fairly soon. There's also, interestingly, at the very beginning, it says that the U.S. and Iran agree that from now on, they will not launch any hostile action against each other and will refrain from the threat or use of force against each other and so on. There's that. I guess I would say, look, it's hard to imagine a restoration of stability and peace to the Middle East that doesn't involve Iran's reintegration into the economy. Now, of course, Israel worries about that, doesn't want that to happen, and I'm sure is worried all the more now that Trump has been, well, you know, he goes back and forth, but lately has been critical of Israel. And it sounds almost like, I'm sure they're worried about him kind of throwing them overboard.
Let me enter in right there, because I do think, you know, that's going to be continue to be a worry. And
yeah,
in 2015, when President Obama was getting ready to sign the Iran deal,
yeah,
that Israel objected to so heartily. Many generals in Israel said, we would prefer to have Iran under sanctions, developing, you know, enriching uranium, because we can always bomb Iran if it gets close to the bomb. But if it gets out of sanctions, it's going to become rich, and it will be able to supply people like Hezbollah or the Houthis, a Syrian regime at the time, all this,
yeah.
It'll be much more dangerous as a wealthy country that doesn't have nuclear weapons than as a sanctioned country that's moving towards nuclear weapons. And I think the plan was that you could bomb that Israel could bomb Iran, and that was the best alternative for Israel. Yeah. And President Trump clearly bought into that, scuttled the JCPOA, and was willing to bomb Iran, and was convinced that, okay, they've got the 60% enrichment, we can bomb them in the same way that Israel had bombed both the Iraqi nuclear plants and the Syrian nuclear plants. So that was the path forward for Israel. Now that path forward has really been thrown up into the air, because you can say, well, this agreement, the memorandum of understanding that Trump is about to sign with Iran, doesn't really end the war in the same way that Gaza hasn't been ended, Lebanon hasn't been ended. There's these ceasefires that are announced turn into open-ended, messy, unresolved conflicts. That's been the pattern in the Middle East. And that Iran could very easily turn into the same thing, because they don't have an agreement on what happens to the enriched uranium, what happens to the nuclear, so forth. All of those things have been left in abeyance. But Iran, you're right, has deterrence today. And I don't think any American president is going to want to bomb Iran again, because it's going to open up that whole question. But as you say, that can bring some security to the Middle East. But I see in the offing, both Turkey and Saudi Arabia have been moving closer and closer together. I think they both see Israel as a true danger to the stability in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And they, before the Iran war, were moving together in what looked like some kind of a defensive agreement with Syria as sort of the weak link, but trying to build up Syria and stabilize Syria, so that Israel could not expand and would, as a replacement to this axis of resistance that had crumbled, Iran-led axis of resistance. And so, you know, of course, nature abhors a vacuum, and I think both Saudi Arabia and Turkey realized, we've got to do something about this. You know, Israel's going to bomb Qatar, it's going to bomb Syria, bomb Lebanon, it's going to destroy the Palestinians. We cannot allow Israel to just constantly destabilize the region at will.
Right.
And therefore, they have to stand up and provide a credible deterrence. I think they're going to continue to feel that way in the future, because Iran has been badly weakened. You know, Iran's going to be hors de combat. Well, it's going go ahead.
Well, I mean, it was weakened in the wake of October 7th by the decimation of Hamas and Hezbollah, although Hezbollah maybe is in slightly better shape than we had thought, judging by its recent performance. But still, I think we agree, right, that the war has strengthened Iran in part by demonstrating this credible deterrence, which is really twofold. Iran is clearly willing to bomb American bases in the region, and right now there are plenty of targets, A. And B, it can close the Strait of Hormuz and is willing to do it. And so, you know, it is stronger now. I mean, this is one reason I think, we do need to worry about how freaked out Israel may be. I mean, look, Israel was already seemingly freaked out in the sense that they felt the need to keep attacking other countries and so on, and taking more territory in Lebanon and Syria and Gaza and the West Bank, those, you know, different cases, but still it was seemingly an aggressively expansionist policy. I mean, I should add that, you know, Israel would say in all of these cases, well, in Syria, it's not even plausible, in terms of the bombing they did after the regime change in Syria, but in the other cases, they'd say, well, they started it. This was retaliation. But still, you step back and it looks like a very aggressive expansionist policy. So they were, and they thought that was necessary, I guess, for their security. So, and now it seems to me they are feeling more insecure than back when they thought that was necessary for the security. So that is like a source of worry. And of course, to just briefly touch on one obvious source of worry. This ceasefire includes a ceasefire in Lebanon. Well, if Israel does not want the ceasefire to hold, that is obviously one of the big things they can fiddle with, right? I mean, peace right. in Lebanon depends on Israel wanting peace in Lebanon. But I guess, what was I originally replying to now? I've gone on so many tangents. But I guess I was saying, I think of Iran is pretty strong now, and that much stronger in light of the ceasefire. I mean,
strategically, it certainly is strong.
Yeah, okay. But
economically, it still has to look over its shoulder. And all the problems that this regime was facing from the Iranian people are going to mm-hmm. pop up again. As soon as this military situation calms down and there's some stability, the people, you know, inflation is well over 100%. Mm-hmm. People's livelihoods have been destroyed. And Iran, the government, is going to have to show that it has a plan for redeveloping Iran. And that means falling in line with this American negotiating stream. Now, as I understand from the MOU, that also includes being able to export their oil. So
right.
that's going to be very important for them gaining money. But they have a long way to go to rebuild and actually become strong. But strategically, you're absolutely right. And I think we can also say that China is a lot stronger because of this. Mm. Russia is a lot stronger because of this. Mm. Saudi Arabia was
now
just...
Why is Russia... I mean, why is either of them a lot stronger because of this? Flesh that out a little, China and Russia.
Well, let's say, you know, Russia has been able to export its oil for high mm-hmm. prices throughout this whole situation.
Okay, now, okay.
Trump's threatening to, you know, snap back those sanctions. But many countries have gotten used to taking the Russian oil, and they're less frightened of the United States than they used to be. Mm-hmm. Russia just had a big conference in St. Petersburg, and Saudi Arabia was the guest of honor. So Russia is wooing Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia is also eager to reach out to Russia. All of these Gulf countries are seeing that the United States cannot protect them, has bad judgment, mm-hmm. and is weaker than they thought. And they're reaching out in every direction. It's very clear that the multipolar world is upon us, and everybody is doing side deals. Qatar and the UAE both made separate deals with Iran during this whole thing in order to try to get their ships out. So they went underneath the U.S. radar and mm-hmm. began negotiating separately with Iran because they don't trust the United States. Yeah. China, China comes out of this, I think, very emboldened. We don't know the terms of whatever China deal was made when President Trump was visiting in China just the last month. But it seems quite clear that he has not agreed to release the weapons systems to Taiwan.
Right.
That were promised. Right. And there was probably some quid pro quo. We won't help Iran rebuild if you don't, we don't help Taiwan. And so China has a lot more leverage now because the United States isn't the clear winner, because it's trying to negotiate with Iran. China can use this Iranian leverage to gain all kinds of benefits. This puts China, I think, in the world balance of power mm-hmm. in a much stronger position than it was before, because the whole world sees the United States as less strong than it used to be and unable to bargain the way it used to be or threaten people the way it used to be.
Yeah. And there's, you know, I think there's something a little more generically weakening about this for the United States that has to do with technology, which is just what one question this raised in very stark form is like, in the current age, you know, the age of drones and so on, like, how valuable are these aircraft carriers? Like, and for that matter, these military bases. I mean, as soon as Iran started firing at these military bases, the U.S. evacuated them. Now, of course, that's partly because we're so casualty averse, which is itself a kind of weakness because it limits.
But the drones and missiles were able to get through all the defenses.
That's one thing I'm saying is our people, you know, much the way tanks were devalued in the Ukraine war as drones and so on played a larger role. I think a lot of American arms, I mean, including even these, you know, very effective defensive missiles, you don't use those against drones. It's too expensive. Now, we will develop, people are developing more effective, you know, they're almost like old-fashioned anti-aircraft gun defenses against drones, except more automated, and that'll happen. But the point is the things that made, well, let's just take Israel. It made Israel feel so secure about America's support of it. You know, we've got these big, expensive Patriot defensive missiles. We've got aircraft carriers. We've got this. It just seems like a lot of that has been devalued by recent technological evolution. And that became evident in the course of this war
You're absolutely right. Drone warfare and missile technology has transformed the battlefield. And bases are yesterday's answer to these problems, because we could bomb all of Iran's bases, but that didn't stop Iran because they had all this mobile ability, both with missiles and with drones. They could hide them in very small places and we couldn't find them. Mm-hmm. And that enabled them to come back and fight another day, even after we proclaimed that they had been destroyed. And our bases all were abandoned and badly hurt. So mobility is clearly the new factor. And America has been caught with its feet in clay throughout the Gulf region. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to, obviously, there's going to be a lot of soul searching in Washington as we try to figure out how to fight the next war.
And that's why, you know, the Gulf states, like, you know, on the one hand, you would imagine there's a lot of residual antagonism toward Iran because Iran attacked pretty much all of them, at least the American bases there, and in some cases went beyond the bases. On the other hand, they're not too pleased with Israel and America because most of them did not want this war to start. And they got aside with somebody for the sake of their security. And that gets back to the question I ask, like, how many of these American military bases are still going to be there in 2 years? I mean, why don't you maybe sketch out a little more the realignment you imagine? So you said already we saw Saudi, you know, there was concern in the region about Israel's seemingly endless ambition for expansion and war. I mean, they were moving on all fronts, you know, and they were, you know, they were attacking Syria, Lebanon.
I think, you know, I think on that line, the Gulf states are going to want to take charge of their own defense.
Well, that's the question. Who do they line up with at the end of this? And back to Saudi Arabia and Turkey, is there not almost a natural, is some alignment with Iran now more natural for them than it was before the war? I mean, so these are like, what's the polarity going to be as it involves the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, and as it involves Turkey?
Well, first of all, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and others are going to want to make their own decisions about when they go to war. In this Iran war, America didn't consult. Mm-hmm. America made the decision that put them in very terrible danger and got Iran to bombard them because they had American bases and they put all their money on American defense.
And that's one way you wind up making the decision about, you get more control over that decision, is get rid of the American bases.
Get rid of the American bases. I think, you know, in the long term, they're going to want to phase them out and they're going to want to be producing their own technology. And I think we see this right across the Middle East. Turkey isn't there yet, but it's developing a fifth generation jet. It's trying to get back into the F-35, manufacturing the engines for the F-35. Whether it can do it or not, I don't know, but they've got very sophisticated drones. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, other Gulf states are trying to onboard that high technology from China, from elsewhere. The U.S. has had enough leverage because it has a monopoly over their defensive systems to keep China out of this. But I think that that leverage is highly diminished. And I think the interest of all these states is going to be to source, to begin to develop their own weaponry, just the way Iran has. I mean, Iran is the abject lesson here that even without an air force, Iran has been able to produce this high technology, which has made it a partner for Russia in the Ukraine war and has allowed it to defend itself against the great superpower. So they're going to copy that. They're going to want their own technology, and they've already shown that. They've used a lot of leverage with the United States to get AI capacity, to get American firms to invest and Chinese firms to invest in high technology sources and missile technology and drone technology within those countries. So I think that's, you know, Iran points a model, and it means downgrading the United States, getting technology wherever it's the best, and trying to produce your own stuff.
And what do you see as relations among Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, say?
Well, I think they're going to try to limit Iran themselves. And
they are. So they still, you think they still see Iran as a threat? Because, I mean, I would think to the extent that all three of them see Israel as a threat, that would be a naturally bonding force. But you think there is still enough mutual suspicion?
Oh, absolutely. You know, not only is there the ideological Sunni Shiite stuff which undergirds this, but the competition over the Persian Gulf and over the flow of ships through the Persian Gulf is only just beginning. You know, now that Iran has got its toll booth, if you will, at the straits, Saudi Arabia and the UAE and the others are going to want to be equal participants in that, in deciding who gets to go through and how. And they're going to build up their capacity to force that issue. They don't trust Iran, and they shouldn't trust Iran. Iran has at least expressed over the last decades wants to be the chief arbiter in the Persian Gulf. You just look at the naming. You know, our center in Oklahoma is called the Iran and Persian Gulf Center for, you know, the Center for Iran and Persian Gulf Studies. And that Persian Gulf was put in there very specifically because the Arabs want it called Arab Gulf. So who is going to control that Gulf comes in every facet. And it's going to continue to be a major, but their cooperation, but we are seeing, you know, a tremendous amount of cooperation. The Saudis, the UAE, all are, and particularly Qatar, have begun negotiating with Iran. And they hope that they could stay out of this war by taking a very different profile and through negotiations with Iran. And I think that's going to be even stronger in the future because they realize this is a lose-lose situation. And it's a lose situation for Iran as well. They have to find a common regime in the Gulf, and this should be a big incentive for doing that.
So who does Iran wind up in the scenario where, and we'll get to the reasons that the ceasefire might not hold, much less lead to an enduring deal involving the nuclear stuff, but it could all work out. And in that event, who do you imagine Iran being most naturally allied with? I mean, Oman, I guess, springs to mind. I don't know what the deal... Yeah.
Of course.
Well, but regionally, I mean, in terms of regional polarity, like what's the deal with Pakistan, for example? But also what's the deal with the other Gulf states? I mean, Bahrain and UAE have actual relations with Israel, right? And Iran isn't wild UAE, about that.
But, you know, the UAE reached out to Israel gambling that there would be regime change in Iran, that Iran, that America and Israel would be successful. And therefore, they threw their cards in with Israel.
Bad bet.
And now we've seen that the UAE has sent envoys to Iran to negotiate, to try to patch that up and to stop any future bombardment of the UAE, as we saw, which was very, which was brutal. It stopped the air flights. It stopped the airport. It damaged many of their facilities. So they can't afford to have that again in the future, and they've moved back. Now, where they ultimately land is unclear because there's clearly a deep competition between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. There are many different differences in the way that their foreign policy is projected. The UAE has been a real enemy of the Muslim Brotherhood and any Islamists in a way that other regional powers have not been, which causes it to side with Israel and the United States in the regional.
In fact, didn't they support the coup in Egypt that installed Sisi, the UAE?
Yes, they did.
So they deposed a Muslim Brotherhood government there.
Yes, they did. They and Israel really teamed together in order to lobby the United States and to get President Obama not to object to Sisi's coup.
Not only that, Obama refused to call it a coup because that would have triggered under American law certain things that he didn't want to trigger, exactly. Even though there's never been a more obvious coup in the history of the world. But go ahead.
Iran is still isolated. China has been playing footsie with Iran, but of course, China has much more important relations with Saudi Arabia, with the UAE, and Middle Eastern powers in general, with the Arab powers, than it does with Iran. So it's very loath to just jump in wholeheartedly with Iran. Yeah. China has been really very deferential to the United States in the Persian Gulf region up until today.
Yeah, but one question is Trump, you know, Trump's a funny guy. I mean, at his heart, he's kind of a realist, right? It's like, at his heart, he wants to do business. In his heart, he wants to do business with other countries. You know, you can imagine him, however paradoxical it sounds, given the fact that he's the guy who assassinated Soleimani, attacked Iran, killed, you know, the whole family of the current supreme leader in Iran. You can imagine him. And you read this memorandum of understanding, and again, it just kind of seems to me pointed in that direction toward, you know, doing more and more business with Iran, integrating it into the economy. And by the way, to the extent that that happens, you know, China's going to want to have more to do with Iran, right? I mean, Iran has tremendous economic potential. There's a lot of talent there, a lot of resources, and a lot of people.
Let me jump in here. Bob, President Trump's entire Middle East strategy is really up in smoke right now. Mm-hmm. He gambled with Israel that the Palestinian issue was over, that he could turn the page on the Palestinian issue and push ahead with the Abraham Accords. And we have to remember that American foreign policy in the Middle East is based really on two legs. One is a special relationship with Israel. And two is oil and Aramco. Mm-hmm. And right at the beginning, in 1948, when we recognized Israel and helped it get on its feet, our foreign policy establishment understood that this was going to cause a clash because the Arabs were going to be aggrieved and they might shut off oil. And they did that in 73 with the oil embargo because America did their special, Nixon did his rearming Israel and major flights there to give them tanks and all sorts of equipment in order to win decisively the 73 war and to keep all their occupied territory. So the Saudis jumped in with the oil embargo, but it underlined how dangerous that was for American policy. Trump thought finally that he could weave those two strands of policy together in a non-confrontational way with the Abraham Accords and forget the Palestinian issue, that it would become yesterday's story, and the Middle East would become an American pond. This Iran war, which was really designed to solve that problem, to destroy Gaza and destroy the axis of resistance, so that Israel would stand astride the Middle East and the Gulf countries would have no choice. Sure, they would lick their wounds for a year or two, but then they would go ahead with the Abraham Accords because there was no reason not to. Mm-hmm. Now, all those issues are unsettled. The Palestine issue is unsettled. The Iran issue is unsettled. In fact, Iran is stronger, as you said, strategically than it used to be. And Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries have taken a step back from the United States and are beginning to reconsider all of these. They're beginning to doubt that the United States has an answer for them. And So Trump is going to come back to the Middle East, and he's going to have to make some hard decisions, because that scenario that you painted of the businessman, the realist who mm-hmm. wants to make money with the Saudis, with the Gulf, with the UAE, and with Iran, frankly.
Right.
He has to weigh that with his Israel first Middle East policy, mm-hmm. which has been, you know, the essential part of his approach to the Middle East, which is Netanyahu knows best. I'm going to follow his lead. And that's not bad for American business, because we can harmonize these two things. And now they're in terrible disharmony. And he's, you know, spotlight, once the dust settles on this Iran war, spotlight is going to move right back to the Palestinians.
Well, I was going to ask you that, and that's interesting, because at the moment, it's not really there. I mean, if you follow the right people on Twitter, you do notice that the ethnic cleansing of the West Bank continues apace, right? I mean, villages are being burned and so on.
But, you know, with midterm elections winding up here,
yeah,
the Democrats and the Republicans are both gearing up. You know, let's say that the sort of anti-Israel wings of both the Democrat and the Republican parties are beginning to get some purchase on this issue. And they're using this issue as a cudgel to slam President Trump and to slam Washington as it has mm-hmm. been. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans have MAGA, you know, we've wasted all this money abroad and you don't care about Americans. And the Democrats are doing exactly the same thing in their own way. And mm-hmm. we will have to see whether that has any real legs. So far, the middle in both parties has held pretty firmly. And yep. this sort of anti-Netanyahu settlement issue has been a periphery. But the problem is, it's not going to go away. The news has, the mainstream press has turned away from the West Bank and Gaza as issues.
That's what I was going to say. That's why I was going to ask you, are you sure this is really going to bring the Palestinians into the spotlight? They're not there yet.
Well, you are right. And the newspapers, the press, is being gobbled up by pro-Israeli. You know, we've seen CBS and the whole, you know, TikTok and the whole...
And CNN, sort of CNN now, right?
...of American news is being gobbled up by very pro-Israeli billionaires who can control the
message. One in particular, in the case of CNN and CBS, right, Larry Ellison, and part of TikTok.
That's a factor. That's a big factor. And we saw with the loss of Massey in Kentucky, there have been some very important voices that have spoken up on this issue and have gotten smacked down. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't promise a real change in the way either party is going to work. You know, we have little outliers in Maine and so forth, but it's hard to see whether that's going to really fly. So you're right. We're in a balance here. And America's got a hard choice to make between a single-minded pro-Israeli policy. And we've heard Trump, you know, we've heard Trump articulating some real criticism of Netanyahu. It's mm-hmm. not the first time, but it's really, he's begun to sort of have an edge to it.
Yeah, this last round seemed to go a little beyond his previously expressed frustration.
But he's made his bed with Israel, and he cannot, he's never going to be able to change.
On the other hand, there is the fact that he's not running for re-election. And so the donors don't mean to him what they used to mean. And I don't know how he feels about the midterm elections. I don't think he has a huge amount of loyalty to the Republican Party per se. He may recognize that if both houses are in Democratic hands, the next few years of his political life will be less smooth than they would be otherwise. But, you know, it's just kind of hard. I mean, Trump is the kind of guy who would just cut loose, you know, people had given him a lot of money and so on. They're in great terms. He'd cut him loose in a heartbeat. So it's very open-ended in my mind what's going to play out. But I also wonder, separate from the question of to what extent Israel's critics could gain more political power in America, what would that mean in the Middle East? I mean, you need to, if you want stability in the long term, you need to give Israel some sort of eventual sense of security, right? I mean, everyone, you need to give everyone's...
Israel has an incredible amount of security today.
Well, you can say that. I honestly, since October 7th, my read is the Israelis, most of the Israelis themselves, I'm not necessarily talking about Netanyahu. He may be just cynically manipulating all these emotions, but I think most of the Israelis themselves look at these actions that to us seem belligerent and aggressive, you know, in Lebanon and wherever else in Gaza, in the West Bank. And I honestly think most Israelis think, yeah, this is to secure our safety, you know? I mean,
I understand
you?
That. But yeah. Israel has a, you know, Israel, militarily, Israel is extraordinarily secure.
For the time being, on the other hand, that
very
much...
The Gaza campaign, which killed 1,300 Israelis,
it was
horrible for Israelis. But it was a little bit like 9/11 for the United States. Mm-hmm. Yes, Hamas got lucky. They managed to break out of a unprotected barbed wire fence, really, or glorified barbed wire fence. Israel can contain that. That's the...
Oh, yeah.
And Israel has taken all this new territory, you know, 1,000 square miles of new territory in Lebanon and Syria and in Gaza. Israel is very powerful. The problem is that Israel is sitting on top of 7 million Palestinians. And that they're displacing and that they're turning into, you know, that they're into an apartheid situation, which the world is not going to turn its gaze away from. And
well,
it's going to undermine everything.
You're less cynical than I am about things that humans are capable of turning their gaze away from, but...
It's maybe a drip, drip. It's a drip, drip. And it's going to undermine, you know, Israel was the shining paragon of the plucky young state that had had the most moral army, that had the...
They've destroyed their own narrative. I mean,
they
would say they had no choice and this was all defensive, but things have played out in such a way that it's just stunning the extent to which the narrative has been reversed. You know, they started out as the victims of the Nazis and now a lot of the world thinks of them as basically the Nazis. It's just unbelievable. How fast is, you know, just the narrative has changed in the eyes of a lot of people. But
and it's hard to see turning that around at this situation because of the expansion in the West Bank and Gaza. The spotlight's going to continue to come back to those two areas,
You can imagine an American president using leverage in a way that changes a lot of things, including things on the West Bank and Gaza, and I think in ways that would ultimately be good for Israel. Granted, it would be unprecedented, but who knows? Well, listen, we are about to go into overtime, available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. I encourage everybody to become one. I do want to, in overtime, start out by pushing back a little about your characterization of how strong Israel's position is now, and then continue that line, but also get into the prospects of the ceasefire itself. Things that could go wrong and you know, how that will play out. But before we bring down the paywall, I just want to remind people that they can get your stuff. First of all, on Twitter, what's your Twitter handle?
It's Joshua_Landis.
L-A-N-D-I-S.
Joshua_Landis.
And where else would you direct people?
Well, I write for articles in foreign policy and so forth, and foreign affairs. But I will push this all on Twitter. Twitter is the best way to keep track of what I'm doing, and I constantly am putting up lectures and other things on that are streaming. But I will link to those on my Twitter site.
Okay. So we will continue this conversation. There's a link in the show notes if you want to become paid subscriber to Non-Zero Newsletter. You can go to nonzero.org and look for this post. Or just look for stuff generally there. I encourage people to hang out there. But thanks, everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime.